The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So this evening I want to talk about a concept that is important in our meditation tradition. And the word has to do with a Pali word, the ancient Buddhist word that is still current in Sanskrit and still very current in India to this day, and it's the word viveka. And generally in English we translate it in a particular way, which I think maybe a lot of people in India wouldn't recognize. And I mean, a little bit over the many years I translate and things like that, and kind of sometimes try to find what the good translation for these ancient Buddhist words are. And I think that most English translations have chosen the word which is probably not ideal for this this word. And the translation that we nowadays in English texts for translating Buddhism, it's translated as seclusion. But seclusion is has kind of connotations of, you know, being locked up or, you know, hidden away or kind of, you know, some people might have positive associations with seclusion, but it's not automatically for many English speakers a positive word and good word. It has some sense, there's some reason to translate it that way. But in America, historically, the word viveka has a very important place in history of American religions, because there was a Swami, an Indian teacher, who came to America in 1893 to the World Parliament of Religions that was held in Chicago. It was the first gathering, kind of ecumenical gathering of religious leaders from all the different religions that were kind of known back then, I guess. And it was actually a major historical event. And coming from India, there was a teacher whose name was Vivekananda. So his name was the Joy of Viveka. And he was a disciple of Ramana Krishna. And he had a big impact at this parliament, and he gave a talk, and they say that he was the one who introduced yoga and Advaita and kind of some of the Indian philosophies and teachings and meditations here in the West. A huge impact. Also, he spoke so wonderfully about kind of ecumenical kind of way that he really was very important in opening up a much broader kind of interfaith dialogue and tolerance and respect. So this Vivekananda was very important. And I'll tell you a tale. If you're living in the hustle and bustle of a busy urban city and rushing around, a lot of things to do, and you know it makes sense to have at least two phones because you can talk on one and check emails on one. Probably three is better, so you can do texting on another one. And I watch teenagers now. I have teenage sons, and they seem completely adept at being on the computer and the phone at the same time. I don't quite understand it, but that seems to be the way. But that's only two. And then there's traffic and people and things to do and rushing around, and there's just a rush and hustle and bustle of life and all that, and important things to accomplish and to prove, and there's always a 15-minute of fame that we're trying to get, and all these things. So rushing about, but then in the middle of the city where all this hustle and bustle is going on, and you're part of it, there's a very large park. And it happens to be that the fastest way to walk across is to go over the park rather than around because of all the traffic. So you decide you're going to walk, through the park, which means up over this very, very large kind of hill. And it's a little mountain. And so you start walking up, and at the big bottom of the park, there's all these people doing the hustle bustle things, but as you get up, not many people go up the steep hill, and you go high enough, after a while, you're kind of above the crowds of people, and And you're in a hurry to get someplace, but maybe there's no cell phone reception up there. And so you stop and you take your breath and you look around and you see all the people are rushing and doing and all this stuff. And you're not part of it, and you're above it all, and you look down, and you say, wow, that's like looking at a colony of ants, you know, rushing around, and it kind of looks like that, you know, and it's amazing, you know, what it looks like, all these people, and where are they, what are they in such a hurry for, and just a little while ago, you were that, but now you're above it, and you're apart from it, and you get a whole different perspective of it, and wow, you can breathe. I had a little taste of that when I was in college. I had lived in an apartment with five other guys, and one day I was down the little balcony we had, and the sliding glass door was closed. And I saw two of my friends in the living room having an animated conversation, but I couldn't hear the words. And that was like really special to be able to watch and have no idea what they said, what I was talking about, and watch how animated they were and engaged they were. It was like the most important thing in the world. But I, you know, it was just gestures, and somehow being apart from that, somehow it showed me there was a whole other way of being, or that I didn't have to be caught up in all these things that I had been caught up in, and it showed me another way. So to be up higher and look down, and you have an overview, and the word overview is what is the actual the word in ancient language that became equanimity. The Pali word upekkha for equanimity has the connotations or the etymology of the word is means to look down from or have an overview of the situation. So sometimes when we can get on a broad overview perspective, we get more equanimous about it. We have the big picture and it's easier. And so we're going up this hill in the park and we're above all the hustle and bustle and we're apart from it. And we say, wow, I'm so glad. I don't have to rush down. Maybe it's good to take my time and just breathe the fresh air and be apart from it all. And, wow, this feels good. I feel like there's more space for me, and it's kind of refreshing to be kind of a little bit more alone and have space and time and time to think, time to be with myself. And so then, as you keep going up, then after a while, the hustle and bustle falls away, and then you realize that to your surprise, you brought the hustle and bustle with you. It's in your mind, the way your mind works. And all these thoughts and concerns about things and desires for this and aversions for that and doubts about what you're doing and all these kind of swirling thoughts and ideas and concerns. And even though it feels like you're breathing room because you're higher up in this nice park mountain and fresh air and it feels good to be there, you're surprised by your busyness of your mind and how you brought it all with you. And this was an experience I had when I went to Burma. I went to Burma many years ago to be at a meditation monastery. And I was there for a long retreat. It was an 8-month long retreat. So for 8 months, I really didn't talk to anyone. I was in silence, just mostly meditating all day long. It was one of the high points of my life. But after about 3 months there, and I was had gotten more still and more concentrated than I'd ever been in my life, it felt like I was down touching really deep, deep down into my mind. And before that, I'd been living at the San Francisco Zen Center for a number of years, practicing Zen. And Zen Center is a community of maybe 150 people in the different centers they have in the Bay Area. And there's all these jobs you have and positions you have and hierarchy you have and status you have and, you know, all these different things. And relationships with people and the teachers and this and that. It's kind of, you know, it's a socially complex place. And so here I was, far away from Zen Center, at this monastery in Burma. Hadn't really talked to anybody for 3 months, except for the meditation teacher, for a few minutes every day. And my mind was really still. I felt like I'd really reached a really deep, beautiful place in my mind. And to my surprise, I had Zen Center thoughts. You know, like this person and talking to this person and concern for this person and our relationship and what positions would I get if I go back and all this kind of stuff. And I said to myself, Gil, what in the world is Zen Center doing deep in your mind? How did I get in there? And that doesn't make sense, you know. And I made a vow to myself, kind of promised myself, that I would not go back to Zen Center until I had Zen Center out of my mind. So for you, you're walking up this mountain in the park, and you're far above everything, and you're just like, oh my, look at this. I brought the whole world with me. And I'm still caught up and preoccupied and all that. And so then you realize that and see that, but then at some point you get an overview of that, and you find yourself, you're not so involved in it. You're not so caught in it. You see it, and you're kind of amazed. Wow, look at this mind. Because you're amazed and have this overview and not so caught in it or caught up in it, either for or against it, the desires, the aversions, the preoccupations begin to fall away. And then there's a deeper peace in the mind, quiet and stillness in the mind. And it's really nice to have all these, you know, you drop all these concerns that you've been carrying with you for so long, and the mind has a cleanliness to it, or an openness to it, or a subtleness, a peacefulness to it. And some people are content with that, and some people come to meditation for experience like that. But in Buddhism, this is really not the point of Buddhism, is to have some experience, some feeling of peace and well-being, but rather to be able to use that as a vantage point to look even deeper into your mind, to discover some of the deepest roots or the deepest places of holding, of attachments, of clinging we have. And there's a series of attachments which are very, very deep, attachments to self. There's a whole world of selfing and identity where there's a fair amount of clinging and holding on. There's attachment to opinions, attachment to values, attachment to religion, attachment to status, attachment to power, attachment to wealth, to security, to all kinds of things. Some of these things are worthwhile pursuing in and of themselves, but it's a pity to have this beautiful depth of the mind caught up in that, preoccupied with it. You don't want to have the depth of your mind not be, to use dramatic language they sometimes use in Buddhism, be polluted by attachments and clinging. And so then the marvelous thing that can happen is you can sometimes actually pull out or have fall away, shed some of these deeper attachments. And then you can go back down into the hustle and bustle. And you come back to the hustle and bustle. See, if you come back to the hustle and bustle before you uproot the attachments, you have a peace. You put aside some of the desires and aversions and preoccupations, but the tendency to get preoccupied is still there. And so you come back down and the peace is not going to last, and pretty soon you're back in the hustle and bustle. But if you're able to really get down to the root of the mind, to the place of these places of deep attachment, and uproot some of them, then those stay away, or you're not going to be tricked by them anymore. And then you come down into the, come back to the hustle and bustle, and you don't have to be caught in the middle of it. And you can go around and do it, but you feel a certain freedom in the mind. So this analogy I'm giving is the analogy for this word viveka. And probably the better translation for it, rather than seclusion, is separation. It's a separation, a shaking out, making a distinction. You see in some dictionaries, they use the word discrimination in the sense of separating out some things. So it's separated, becoming separate. And the tradition talks about three kinds of viveka, three kinds of separation. The first is kaya viveka, which means physical or bodily separation, where you take your body and your body is separated from the hustle and bustle. You go someplace where it's more peaceful and more settled. This is where the idea of a solitude becomes quite nice. There's probably, it's hard, I think, to have a very deep spiritual life without some healthy solitude. Solitude, though, is often covered over and crusted by things like alienation and loneliness and fear, and you know, there's a lot of kind of difficulties, difficult connections people have with solitude. But the idea is that there's, if a person doesn't feel alienated or feels like they're pushed out or feels like they don't feel they don't belong or they don't feel alienated, that or lonely, being alone and in solitude is really a precious thing because of the way in which it allows us to get an overview of things that's hard to see if we're always in the hustle and bustle, always busy running around doing, getting, wanting, and all these things. And so there's a long tradition of people who do meditation in Buddhism spending some time away from the ordinary life. And sometimes they go spend time alone, sometimes they go, we have silent retreats where it's kind of solitary, except you're doing it with 40 people. But you know, they don't talk to not much talking, mostly done in silence, and it really allows and you know, going into solitude in this way, the language we use is retreat, and so kind of retreating from the busyness of life, so we can see ourselves, see the world from a different perspective, to get the overview. So this is kind of the physical separation. Is a kind of a considered important step. The second separation is to separate oneself from the ordinary preoccupations of the mind, the desires of everything things we want and wanting and planning, expecting, and also to separate ourselves from all the aversions and angers and resentments we have. And generally, they talk about the five hindrances, if you know what those are. And this is usually seen as a temporary separation. When the mind gets quiet enough, concentrated enough, the mindfulness gets strong enough, it's kind of like getting higher up on that mountain. So these begin to fall away, and then we have a clarity and a stability of the mind, which is really useful to start looking deeper into the heart and really seeing what's going on here. And so this is called mental separation, citta viveka, where the mind becomes separated from its preoccupations. And at some point, it becomes separated from its attachments, upadhi viveka. And this is usually requires a very still and focused and very attentive mind. Not a lazy mind, not a mind that is peaceful and kind of spacing out, but a peaceful mind that's very attentive, very sharp, very kind of refined. It's kind of like you've made your mind into a very fine instrument. When the mind is very peaceful, very calm, very focused, very concentrated, but the mindfulness is very clear. And there's a tremendous clarity and precision in how we're present for things. It's not vague, it's not spacey. And in that state, sometimes that's where we start touching or massaging or the mind itself starts releasing some of the deepest clingings we have. And when those clingings fall away and we're separated from the clingings, that's called this upadhi viveka, which is the separation from the attachments. And if you do this well, that becomes kind of a permanent thing, a whole new lens through which you see your life. And then, of course, we're going to come back into the world. In Zen, they have the language of coming back from that kind of journey with gift-bestowing hands. So we come back in a different way with a different kind of heart, a different kind of eyes to see what's important and what different things. We start valuing different things than we did before, and we probably were not going to value some of the consumerisms that we have or some of the status things or pursuit of power or only the pursuit of pleasure. So all kinds of things that kind of fall away. And And there can be, because of this upadhi viveka, this separation from attachments, there can be this deep wellspring inside of peace, of calm, of well-being, because of this place inside that it now becomes separated, not from the world, not from oneself, but it's become separated from the attachments. They're no longer there. And so, classically, in our tradition, these three different separations are one description of the journey that people take. And the first one, as I said, is more physical. So in some ways, that's easier to attain. And that can be as simple as, you want nice solitude. Maybe once in a while, get up an hour earlier in the morning before everybody else is up. Get up at 5, and just maybe like no one's up in the neighborhood yet. And so you don't have to go off into some Himalaya mountain to be solitary. It's just like so, it can be so exquisite sometimes to be alone and quiet before the urban life begins to start up. Or maybe go into a park. And it can be lovely to meditate in a quiet park by yourself. This idea of having solitude. And then the second kind of viveka, the separation from our preoccupations, takes time. It takes wisdom. It takes really understanding the nature of the mind, what's going on in the mind, and what's important to pay attention to, what's important to do with the mind. And that you can't just automatically sit down and just try to quiet and calm the mind from its preoccupation too easily to sit down and do it. It takes practice, but it takes more than just practice. It really helps to start becoming wise about desires, wise about preoccupations. So have the overview of them so that you're not pulled into their tricks. They're like tricksters, these things, and we get pulled into them and we think they're the most important thing. And so that takes studying them and being mindful of them and understanding them. And as we understand them better and understand how the trick works so we get caught up in their orbit, then it's easier not to get caught and becomes we have this separation from our preoccupations. And then we go on for that to the last one. So viveka. My impression is that in India to this day, in some traditions, it's a very important word. Sometimes I have had the impression that it's sometimes used almost like liberation itself, or awakening itself. That has this very strong, wonderful connotation. And I don't know if we can get separation, the word separation, to have that wonderful feeling. So sometimes I've experimented to use the word independence for viveka, so physical independence. So the body is no longer dependent on the hustle and bustle in the world, and then mental independence, where we're kind of no longer caught up in our own preoccupations, and then independence from our attachments. And perhaps if it's independence, at least in that part of American culture that seems to like independence. Maybe this idea will have a little bit more pizzazz and seem a little bit more relevant. So, seclusion, solitude, separation, independence. This is an interesting word. And the last thing, there's a In fact, the monastery that we're in our scene, the kind of in England, that's kind of part of sister or sibling, part of our Buddhist family, is called Citta Viveka, and so the independence of mind. So those are my thoughts today. We have about 10 minutes. So if you have any questions about that or about anything you'd like to ask, you're welcome to bring up any topic.
I want to ask, you were talking about you were meditating in Burma, and you had this sudden realization
I felt that it did work in terms of getting Zen centered out of my mind. When I did come back, I had no need or particularly interest in returning to that world. It turned out that I did, and I was happy to do that. But it wasn't exactly, that was part to do with circumstances that I ended up back at Zen Center. And I was together, I had a girlfriend who really wanted to be back there, so I went along and I was came back, and then I was back in that orbit. So that worked. I think it worked pretty well, and that for me, that, and I think my participation with Zen Center then was a lot more free than it had been before. There was a certain one of the reasons I went to Burma to do this long practice was I had recognized in earlier retreats a certain attachment to self that existed deep in the mind. It was a kind of attachment to self that, you know, it wasn't like an ordinary attachment that we can identify, like I'm attached to being X or into that, but it felt more like a little seed of pressure or a little seed of tension that I somehow identified with, this is who I really am or something like that. And I felt like this is something that became essential for me to come back and touch or to see or understand again. It became like the most important thing in my life for me, because I can't tell you, it wasn't like logical exactly, but there was almost this deep heartfelt drive or inspiration or aspiration to touch that and somehow settle some issues that it represented. And when I left after that, after 8 months, that had disappeared. And I didn't see it disappear, but I had very deep experiences there, very deep experiences of release. And I think in that process, whatever that was uprooted or released.
Thank you, Gil. I'm curious if you could talk a little more about release.
Yeah, can you give her a different mic? I think the battery must be going low. Yeah.
Testing. Okay. Thank you. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit more about release from daily preoccupations of the mind and the mechanics of making that happen?
Yeah, that's reasonable to ask. So there's a variety of ways. Depends on the person and the issues, what's going on. Certainly regular practice of meditation. If we want to use meditation as the, since we're a meditation center here, there's other ways to do it besides meditating. But we'll use this now as the reference point. So there's two general ways. One way is through understanding, and the other way is through concentration. So, and associated states. So, with concentration means that you develop the mind to be strong enough to override the preoccupations. And there's a nice thing that as the mind gets a little bit more, so you keep focusing, for example, back on the breath. And every time you focus on the breath, there's a little bit, the energy that would have been available, that you would have been using for your preoccupation goes into your breathing. And so it's kind of like, if you want to turn off a gushing hose of water, you have to turn the faucet, but maybe, you know, you've turned a little bit, little bit, little bit, and slowly, slowly the flow starts, you know, to decrease. So every time you bring your attention away from your thoughts back to your breathing and let the thoughts get quiet, you turn the faucet a little bit down. But they'll come back, right? And they come back, and they come back. But slowly, you keep doing it over and over again. The strength of the faucet becomes less and less open, or the strength of those thoughts decreases, and then it's replaced with greater strength for the concentration. And that then eventually all the preoccupations just kind of fade away, and things get quiet that way. That's one way. The other way, which is more the mindful way, is to not always turn towards the breathing, you know, object of concentration, but actually turn towards the preoccupations and look them right in the eye. Kind of this idea of being up the mountain and looking down and having an overview is, you're getting kind of a bird's eye view of it, or taking a really kind of looking at it well and learning to how it works for you. And sometimes there's taking a really good look at thinking and how thinking works, the energy of it, the emotions connected to it, that begins to kind of dislodge the way that we're so wedded to it. And we begin to kind of, the glue that ties us to it begins to soften and dissolve because we understand it, because we see how it all works. And slowly we find ourselves more and more with the overview, and as we have the overview or the clear observation of it, the strength of it. It's another way that decreases the strength of the preoccupations, and they slowly fade away. And sometimes they fade away quickly if we say, wait a minute, this is not interesting. But as long as we think it's interesting, fascinating, then it's a little bit harder. But so you have to kind of break the fascination with our thoughts. We have better things to do than to think sometimes. That's okay. Is that good?
Thank you.
Okay. So you can bring the mic. Sit something over.
Thanks. So the word that comes to mind is distinctions.
Extinction.
Distinctions.
Distinction, yes.
I see the skills of making distinction along that path, which is consistent with this overview.
Yes.
I keep noticing this in the past year or two, is this distinction activity is really where I have a lot of leverage of. I see like this different perspective, that there is no one way to read one thing.
Nice.
And be attached to one picture of flow of it.
Yeah. So one of the purposes of mindfulness, the quiet, still, focused mindfulness, is to make better distinctions, to see more clearly the different things going on in the mind. And when the mind is just a big buzzing, overcrowded metropolitan traffic, it's all kind of confusing. It's hard enough to get one's bearing and find a way. But if once you get quiet enough to start seeing, there's that, then eventually you start seeing even gaps between them, that there's more peace, or we can make a distinction between we start seeing, for example, like every time I'm preoccupied, I'm clenching my jaw. But I don't have to clench my jaw. And the distinction between a clenched jaw and an unclenched jaw starts standing out. And then you can choose the unclenched jaw. And then you find that your thoughts are not quite as strong as they were. Yeah. The idea of distinction is a really good one.
Yeah, well, I thought I found my own hack, but that's good.
Great. Yes, maybe the last one.
It's more of a statement. So my first language is Sinhala. And in that, we have the word viveka.
Uh-huh.
And the interpretation is rest.
What?
Rest.
Rest.
Yes.
Oh, how nice. Rest.
So I thought that's pretty relevant.
Yeah, wonderful. That's fantastic. I didn't know that. That's lovely.
So thank you.
So let's go and get some rest. Sleep is a kind of viveka. It's kind of a physical solitude, to some, you close your eyes and maybe you hope that in sleep you get the mental solitude or separation from your preoccupations. And it would be really nice if you could wake up without your attachments. So enjoy your sleep. Thank you.